Blog Talk Radio.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We celebrate 15 years of our broadcast and podcast.
Then we talk with the author and psychologist, Dr. Marlene Winnell,
about religious trauma syndrome and her book, Leaving the Fold, A Guide for Former Fundamentalists.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The shipwreck off the Libyan coast has reportedly claimed the lives of 130 people, despite SOS calls for help, the UN Migration Agency, IOM, said on Friday. The tragedy was confirmed late on Thursday by the volunteer rescue vessel Ocean Viking. It reported seeing dozens of bodies floating in the water next to the stricken inflatable vessel, said IOM spokesman Safa Massali, speaking in Geneva.
The reports say that 130 people were on board the rubber dinghy for 2 days before they sank in the central Mediterranean. For 2 days, the NGO Alarm Phone, which is responsible for sending distress calls to the relevant maritime rescue centres in the Mediterranean region, has been calling on states to uphold their responsibilities towards these people and send rescue vessels. Unfortunately, that has not happened.
Close to 500 people have now drowned in the Mediterranean Sea this year, almost three times as many as the same period last year. Over the past 3 days, there have been reports of at least two other boats carrying migrants in the central Mediterranean, Ms. Maselli noted. One boat was intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard, and 103 or more people were returned to Libya and detained, while a mother and child were found dead on board. The third boat has been out at sea for 3 days, and what we fear is that the worst has happened, Ms. Maselli said. Given the status and the state of these boats, given the length and duration that the people are spending in what remains the most dangerous sea crossing in the world. In Ukraine, a UN-led humanitarian convoy has delivered 23 tons of hygiene items across a newly reopened crossing point on the contact line in the east of the country. Announcing Thursday's operation in Donetsk, the Humanitarian Coordination Office, OCHA, confirmed this was the second UN convoy to cross at Novotrotsky since it reopened to aid materials a little over a week ago. It's still the only crossing point that remains operational for humanitarian aid delivery on the contact line, said OCHA spokesperson Jens Lark. The first delivery was on Thursday, the 15th of April, when five trucks crossed with 18 tons of COVID-19 supplies to the non-government controlled area in Donetsk. Needs remain high in the east after years of conflict between government and separatist forces on the Russian border, with nearly 1.7 million people in need of assistance in Donetsk and Luhansk. These include the elderly, people with disabilities, female-headed households, and children are among the most vulnerable, the OCHA said. To Ethiopia now, where more than 1 million people have been displaced in northern Tigray and neighbouring Afar and Amhara regions amid ongoing conflict. The data comes from the UN Migration Agency, IOM, which indicated that people are fleeing to towns and cities to seek humanitarian assistance and gain access to essential services. Just over 1 million people are homeless in the Tigray region, along with another 45,000 in Afar and nearly 19,000 in Amhara, according to IOM's displacement tracking matrix. The actual number of people in need may be much higher, as the UN agency was unable to access many areas in northwestern, central, eastern and southern Tigray owing to continuing insecurity linked to conflict which erupted last November. The highest number of people in need is in Shire, where there are more than 445,000 internally displaced people. They're living in overcrowded shelters, including schools within the host community and in open spaces, having come for the most part from western and northwestern Tigray. Life-saving food assistance is among the most urgent need, along with emergency shelter and non-food items, including bedding and kitchen sets, access to healthcare services, water, sanitation, hygiene, and nutrition and protection services. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. See if you try.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and happy spring. Saturday, March 20th is the vernal equinox. Very welcome.
And I'm Dan Barker, co-host of the show. This is the March 18th, 2021 edition of Free Thought Radio, and Annie Laurie and I are hosting from our home, our makeshift home studio in Madison, Wisconsin, while once again, the great Buzz Kemper is engineering from Audio for the Arts, which is his recording studio near the Wisconsin State Capitol.
And Free Thought Radio, even through this pandemic, is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, founded in the 1970s and today the nation's largest association of freethinkers, atheists, agnostics, working to keep religion out of government, which is a chronic issue. And we would love to have your support as a member, if you're not one already, at ffrf.org.
In the second half of our show today, we're going to talk about atheism and health. Is atheism bad for your health, or is it good? Our guest today, Dr. David Speed from the University of New Brunswick, will tell us about his study that has some surprising findings.
And in a few minutes, we will talk about the effectiveness of thoughts and prayers.
This week is the birthday of the composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim. He was born March 22nd, 1930, so he'll be 91 this week. Sondheim is a lifelong atheist. Today, we'll hear some of his music, including, during the breaks, including Send in the Clowns, Last Midnight, Follies Overture, and Comedy Tonight.
On our TV show, Free Thought Matters, we talk with a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, Congressman Jerry McNerney, representing California's 9th Congressional District. Representative McNerney is a member of the Congressional Freethought Caucus.
And during our show, we ask Representative McNerney if it's a good idea to mix religion and government.
Once you start using religious dogma or religious ideology or require rituals that are religious-based, you introduce an element into governance that can be difficult and perhaps dangerous for members of society that don't agree with those ideas. If we want to move forward as a great nation, and everybody does that want to move forward as a great nation, we need to have ideas from the entire spectrum of our society and work together on a collaboration, which is really the only way to make legislation that's sustainable and beneficial.
So you can watch that entire Free Thought Matters interview with U.S. Representative Jerry McNerney this Sunday on broadcast TV in Chicago, Denver, Houston, Los Angeles, Madison, Wisconsin, Minneapolis, New York City, Phoenix, Portland, Oregon, Sacramento, Seattle, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco.
For stations and times, check ffrf.org/news. There's a drop-down for Free Thought Matters. You can also watch the show now already and previous shows at FFRF's Free Thought Matters YouTube channel.
On our weekly Ask an Atheist show on Facebook Live this past Wednesday, we talked about the forgotten founder, Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, which motivated the colonists to rebel against the King of England. And he is the founding father who named the United States of America. We were joined on that show by Margaret Downey, who's organizing remembrances for Paine, and with the sculptor Zenas Froudakis, who's creating a statue of Thomas Paine that we hope will find a home someday in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, we'll be talking more about that campaign. Thomas Paine, of course, was born in England, where he's also been forgotten. So we were also joined on Ask an Atheist by British cartoonist Paul Fitzgerald of Manchester, England, who's making an illustrated graphic novel called Tom Paine's Bones. Fitzgerald is also trying to revive Paine's memory.
I think he's absolutely a forgotten hero. And, you know, that, I presume you're immediately seeing that the graphic novels that I'm interested in tend to be things that nobody else seems to want to talk about. I've always felt that if a piece of history or a character has been forgotten inappropriately, then there's usually a very strong political reason for it. And in the case of Thomas Paine, of course, he was a great American hero until he wrote The Age of Reason, which attacked mainstream religion. His voice in Age of Reason is really interesting because he sounds so modern. He sounds so much like somebody like Richard Dawkins.
That was Paul Fitzgerald of Manchester, England, talking about Thomas Paine. You can join us during that show on Wednesdays at noon Central each week on FFRF's Ask an Atheist, where you can ask questions during the live show.
That's on Facebook Live, but then they go up on YouTube, so you can watch that on YouTube.
They're all, the past shows are all available on YouTube.
And, of course, we had artists, so you do want to see. You want to see the graphics that Paul Fitzgerald produced and this statue to be of Thomas Paine by Zenos Fridakis.
So speaking of the UK, there's some really good news out of Scotland. Scotland voted to repeal its old blasphemy law. That provision dates back to 1825. It's not been enforced for a century and a half. The repeal of the blasphemy law was part of a broader bill updating Scotland's hate crime laws, following in the footsteps of Ireland, which scrapped its own blasphemy law in 2018. So we commend the Humanist Society in Scotland for working on this effort. And the Scottish Constitution includes prohibitions on religious discrimination. It says all citizens have the right to freedom of religion or none. So congratulations, Scotland.
And as you always say, Dan, blasphemy is a victimless crime, but blasphemy laws have a lot of victims. So these laws in the Western world are used to justify blasphemy laws, persecutions, deaths in Islamic countries. So we also wanted this week to point out the extreme religious views of the Georgia shooter, and we are still learning more, but it does seem like the extreme religious views had a big role in this Georgia shooting of 8 individuals, including 6 Asian American women, at massage parlors in Atlanta 2 days ago. Horrible situation, but his hang-up with sex seemed to be a great deal of what motivated him. We're still learning more, but if you want to know more about his religious background, we have a press release that went up yesterday, March 17th, under our news link.
Then, the Freedom From Religion Foundation is calling out U.S. Representative Clay Higgins, who represents Louisiana's 3rd Congressional District, for his religious rhetoric delivered on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives last week. Listen to a little bit of what he said.
There's a higher authority than the law of man. Above the speaker's podium are the words in this great chamber, "In God we trust." Do we? Do we recognize that the biblical record is replete with the violence of man? Shall we admit that laws designed to restrict Second Amendment rights and freedoms are but a veil to conceal the violence of man born since Adam?
Well, he sounds like a preacher.
Yeah, he sure does. And well, we wrote him a letter and told him thoughts and prayers are meaningless and hollow. We deserve better. He should get off his knees and get to work. You can read our letter also at the news link. How bizarre. As Representative Jamie Raskin put it, this legislator did not put his hand on a Constitution and swear allegiance to the Bible. It was the other way around. We wish he wouldn't use the Bible at all. But
he went on to connect Adam and Eve with the Second Amendment.
And of course, this came out even before the Georgia mass shooting. And the secular movement largely supports gun safety regulations. So long as we have nothing in place, then we are going to continue to have these senseless tragedies motivated by religion, by racism, by what sexism, by whatever. It's ridiculous. We need some rational laws.
So we have some victories to report due to the efforts of our legal staff.
And joining us, waiting patiently, is our attorney, our intake attorney, Maddie Ziegler. And it's been a while since you've been on Free Thought Radio. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to talk to you both.
So we thought that who better to talk about some of these victories than you, Maddie? Do you want to talk a little bit about intake, what happens when you get complaints, and about these 3 victories this week?
Yeah, so typically people come to our website and fill out our web form or contact us in a few other ways and let us know about separation of state and church issues that are going on in their communities. And then we investigate those and send letters of complaint where we believe that there is a violation occurring. And pretty frequently we're able to get those stopped. So I'm here to talk about, a few of our recent victories coming off of those letters of complaint.
And two were very significant to do with school board prayer in two different states. Shall we start with those?
Yeah. So our legal fellow, Joseph McDonald, wrote to the Griffith Public Schools in Indiana. They had been opening each of their meetings with a prayer led by a member of the board or a guest, sometimes a clergy member. And these were invariably Christian prayers. And so we sent a letter of complaint, and they recently told us that they are going to be replacing those prayers with a moment of silence at their meetings. And they unanimously decided that after receiving our letter.
And Maddie, briefly, this is very significant because we have had to litigate over such things to stop it. You know, we had a big case in California that went all the way up to the Ninth Circuit, for example. So it's very good to see the school district acceding to the legal arguments and doing the right thing without our having to go to court.
Yes, absolutely. And school board prayer in particular, and because of that case we took, has been, I think, an area of the law where we've been, really been able to do some good all over the country stopping these sorts of things, which leads very well into the next one we're going to talk about, which is another one of these school board prayer complaints. This was one that I handled in the Montrose Area School District in Pennsylvania, and they had a practice of opening every meeting with a recitation of the Lord's Prayer, and apparently all nine of the school board members would participate in this, and, you know, of course, this being a school board meeting, you know, students are often present.
We should point out that the Lord's Prayer is part of the New Testament. It is clearly sectarian prayer.
Yes, absolutely. So I sent a letter of complaint about this one, and they let us know that the practice has ceased and will no longer continue.
Well, congratulations. And do you remember when you sent that letter, how long did it take to get a reply?
That one was a pretty quick turnaround, I think. I sent a letter in February, and I think we got a response about a month later, which is
terrific.
Pretty quick.
Well, congratulations to you and Joseph.
Thank you.
And then what's the other?
Michigan. Something about Michigan has religious content and it's licensing materials?
Yeah, the Michigan Department of Insurance and Financial Services had required study materials for people who wanted to become licensed insurance agents, and they had an ethics exam. And the materials to study for that included some statements about, you know, basically the morality of religion and religious people. Saying that in both business and personal situations, highly religious people are likely to act in ways that most will regard as ethical, essentially because of their religious beliefs. And then moreover, those for whom religion is not a central force in their lives are more likely to act in a self-centered, ethically questionable way. And they also have that religious leaders are the opposite of gangsters and serial killers.
Wow.
So these are obviously very, very objectionable to those of us who are non-religious. So we sent a letter of complaint to the department, and we're recently informed that this has been removed from their materials going forward.
Well, congratulations. Those are three great victories. I know the legal staff, all 10 of you, are working very hard sending out letters, and it's nice to have these clear victories without having to go to court. Thank you, Maddie Ziegler, for joining us today.
Thank you.
So we're going to take a break. After the break, we're going to talk about thoughts and prayers. And then Professor David Speed from the University of New Brunswick will tell us about his study that asks, Is religion good for your health? I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio.
Steve Pinker. In my book, Enlightenment Now, I show that the world has become a better place as reason has been overcoming superstition and tribalism. But the values of the Enlightenment are under attack. That's why I'm a proud member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest association of free thinkers working to keep state and church separate. Please join me in supporting the Freedom From Religion Foundation to ensure that our government is driven not by religion, but by reason.
Margaret Sanger's motto was, no gods, no masters. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. Welcome back. Annie Laurie and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, working to keep state and church separate and to educate the public about the views of the non-theists, the non-religious, atheists, agnostics, secular humanists, the none of the aboves. A year ago this week, when it was becoming clear that COVID-19 was going to be a serious problem, when there were 100 deaths in the United States from the pandemic, President Trump declared a national day of prayer. He said, "It is my great honor to declare Sunday, March 15th, as a national day of prayer. We are a country that throughout our history has looked to God for protection and strength in times like these. No matter where you may be, I encourage you to turn towards prayer in an act of faith. Together, we will easily prevail."
Of course, we did not easily prevail. Nothing fails like prayer, which is the motto of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. That was a slogan by my mother, Ann Gaylor, who was the principal founder of FFRF, and it was so popular it's now on a bumper sticker. Tragically, there have been more than 500,000 deaths since Trump asked for his so-called God to protect our country, almost 3 million known deaths worldwide. And prayer did not provide the answer or produce the vaccines. Science did, and scientists, and many unsung heroes. In the wake of tragedies, hurricanes, wildfires, and mass shootings, public officials frequently offer thoughts and prayers.
Just want to extend our thoughts and prayers.
Our thoughts and prayers are with the victims and families.
We send our thoughts and prayers to our colleague.
Thoughts and prayers are with the family.
Our thoughts and prayers today are with the victims and survivors in Las Vegas.
I would just add my thoughts and prayers.
Prince Philip and I send our thoughts and prayers to all Australians at this difficult time.
I'd like to again send our thoughts and prayers.
We send our thoughts and prayers to them.
I think you recognize all of those people thinking and praying rather than actually doing something. Prayer is what you do when you don't know what to do. That's why it was refreshing to hear Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer last week actually dismissing thoughts and prayers while calling for expanded background checks on gun sales.
The legislative graveyard is over. H.R. 8 will be on the floor of the Senate, and we will see where everybody stands. No more hopes and prayers, thoughts and prayers. A vote is what we need. A vote, not thoughts and prayers.
Hear, hear. Schumer was not the first to say this. In 2015, President Obama commented on the tragic shooting in Roseburg, Oregon. So many shootings that they all blur together. And he said thoughts and prayers are not enough.
Our thoughts and prayers are not enough. It's not enough. It does not capture the heartache and grief and anger that we should feel. and it does nothing to prevent this carnage from being inflicted someplace else in America.
But, you know, I would say thoughts can make a difference. We need to think rationally about gun control and gun safety, and that's what is lacking. Instead, we are turning to cliched prayer.
Well, we have to think, but then we have to act. So let's listen to what the singer-songwriter Roy Zimmerman has to say about thoughts and prayers.
Another day, another crazy loner with a gun. Another mad jihadi's done what cannot be undone. The congressperson semi-automatically declares, to the victims of this tragedy we send our thoughts and prayers. If guns are regulated, well, we're on a slippery slope to common sense and public safety, reason, peace, and hope. But rest assured, we've got the issue square in our crosshairs. And to the victims of this tragedy, we send our thoughts and prayers. Let's work for open carry, so Curly, Moe, and Larry can act like Dirty Harry. Now let us pray for peace. Throw another AK-47 in the cart for hunting deer, of course, who might be shopping at Walmart. We answer to a higher truth called what the market bears, and to the victims of this tragedy we send our thoughts and prayers. Our words say we're so sorry, and our actions say who cares, and to the victims of this tragedy of every subsequent tragedy, we'll send only our thoughts and prayers.
That's Roy Zimmerman, always funny, always telling it like it is, to the victims of this tragedy is the song. And while we have another minute, in other news this week, we've also issued a statement condemning, of course, the predictable Catholic Church's Vatican stance against same-sex marriages, same priest cannot bless them. More insult from the Catholic Church. Liberal Catholics should exit en masse and stop promoting and supporting this archaic and pernicious institution.
I like that. Catholics should exit en masse. So we're going to take a break. This is Free Thought Radio. After the break, we will ask Professor David Speed from the University of New Brunswick, if atheism is good for your health. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at ffrf.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers.
It ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. It ain't necessarily so, the things that you're liable to read in the Bible.
So, Dan, you just got your second vaccination this week.
I did. I'm one of the two-shot people now. And I had a little bit of a reaction this week from the second shot, but I think that's good. It means the vaccine is doing its job. Last week, we reported that atheists, like us, are more likely to get vaccinated than any other group. According to a recent Pew study, 90% of atheists say they definitely or probably will get the COVID-19 vaccine or already got their first shot. That's compared to 77% of Catholics, 62% of Protestants overall. Only 54% of white evangelicals say that they will get vaccinated, which means almost half say they won't.
And this is because atheists have a reputation for putting our faith in science, not superstition.
Well, that's probably true, but you know, there's been a lot of studies and media stories in recent years reporting that religion is good for your health. A 2019 article in Forbes magazine says there's ample reason to believe that faith in a higher power is associated with health and in a positive way. Well, is that true? Is religion good for you? Does it mean that atheism might be bad for you?
Our guest today, Professor David Speed, doesn't think so. David Speed teaches psychology, graduate statistics, and research methodology at the University of New Brunswick. His primary interest is in the relationship between non-religion and health. He's a graduate of the Masters of Applied Social Psychology program and the Doctoral Psychology program at Memorial University of Newfoundland. He has worked as a research officer at the Newfoundland and Labrador Center for Applied Health Research.
Dr. Speed authored an article that caught our eye in the Journal of Religion and Health in January. The article's called Godless in the Great White North. It assesses the health of atheists using data from the Canadian Community Health Survey, and it comes to some interesting conclusions. And we have Dr. Speed on the phone today from New Brunswick. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been studying health and religion and atheism and all of that. What got you interested in that topic?
So I initially started the topic when I was writing my getting my doctoral degree. The thing that you do in research is you have to become an expert in a very narrow area. You become a very boring dinner guest after that fact, but you become very knowledgeable in one specific thing. And the thing that I just happened to fall into was the relationship between religion and health. And because that had been done a lot, I started investigating the relationship between non-religion and health.
So here's the question, the $64,000 question. Is atheism bad for your health?
This is a very complicated question. So as a good researcher, I would say there is a lack of evidence to suggest that atheism is bad for you. And I would probably wager, if I was a betting person, I'm not because I'm really not a fun person, I would argue it's probably not good or bad for your health on average. It's probably just a thing. I think there are maybe cases where being an atheist probably confers some health advantage, but I would guess that's probably operating through something to do with not that they don't believe in God. It's something related to it. Like, you know, like you had mentioned, the trust in science. Atheists are more likely to trust in science. Atheists, like you said, are more likely to express a willingness to get vaccinated. So there might be a health advantage in that case relative to groups who say don't trust in science and would refuse to be vaccinated.
So why are all these studies that we're reading, like that Forbes study that I quoted, why are all of them saying that religion is actually better for your health?
Well, to summarize, and because I have to summarize, because I would speak to this topic for at least several weeks before just running out of steam. Part of the reason is that there's a tendency to misattribute what exactly is happening within a relationship, I suspect. And there's also a mistake of statistical significance with practical significance. So if any of your listeners or people who frequent the show, if they know anything about research methods or statistics, you might have heard of something called p-values. And p-values are this metric in statistics that tell you whether or not one estimate is different from another estimate. So if I say, hey, I'm 5 foot one, give or take 10 feet, and someone else is like 6 foot, we would probably say that we would probably not really distinguish between our two heights because that margin of error is so large that we can't really say there's any difference. But if you have thousands and thousands and thousands of people providing data, any non-zero difference is going to always come back as statistically significant. So if you were to find one group was, say, 3.5 units of health and the other group was 3.501 units of health, you would say, oh, the second group is healthier. But it's not discussing the magnitude of the effect. And the magnitude of the actual health effects are really, really tiny. So there was a recent review article published in the past couple of years where they were looking at how religious attendance accounted for, I think it was like life satisfaction. So if I told you that religious attendance was important to your health, how much variability do you think it would account for life satisfaction? You might guess 50%. No, it's not 50%. 10%? No, it's not 10%. 5%? Not 5%. 2%? Not 2%. 1%? Not 1%. It's about 0.5% of all the variability. And that's with people assuming, and I'm like, I'll play devil's advocate. Let's assume there's a causal relationship. Let's assume that this isn't operating through secular mechanisms. The best case scenario is you're looking at some contribution to health, less than 1%. So why are we making such a big deal out of this?
Well, it seems like it's deference and to religion, and you know the media tend to be unfortunately very happy to promote all of these studies saying religion's good for your health. I guess it's good for headlines.
Yeah, it is definitely good for headlines. I read the Forbes interview and I was pulling out what was left of my hair when I was reading it, and it was really surprising because it seemed to suggest that there wasn't an abundance of literature addressing religion and health. And in fact, there's an enormous amount of literature. They have entire publications, like journals devoted to the study of religion and health. I've actually published in the Journal of Religion and Health several times. It was a really weird narrative. However, non-religious groups are actually understudied. And the really kind of surprising thing is there kind of lies in the study this red flag that something is not right. Because if we think that religion and health, there's a positive relationship between the two, then it stands to reason that, well, non-religion should be associated with like worse health. But when we actually dig into it, we can't really replicate that finding. So if I told you that like smoking is bad for your health, but you find similar health outcomes for smokers and non-smokers, this would seem really odd. And this is what's going on with a lot of the religion health field, which personally I find it frustrating. As a researcher, it's great because it gives me oodles and oodles to publish on.
Well, Professor Speed, one thing that's always irritated me is so many of these studies are based on the fact that that people who are healthier, they say people who go to church are healthier than people who don't go to church, but the people who are too sick or infirm to be mobile don't go to church. So it's like a, I don't know, self-fulfilling prophecy or something. Isn't that one of the problems you see?
Honestly, Annie Laurie, if I didn't know better, I would swear that you are going through my email because I literally just got back a feedback from a manuscript that myself and my talented graduate student, Allison Lamont, submitted. We're doing revisions now. We're optimistic it will be published. But this is a point we make in one of the manuscripts. So we look at religious attendance predicting life satisfaction, and then we see whether or not it varies across levels of how healthy a person is. Because you're right, there is absolutely a self-selection bias going in with this. If I'm not well enough to leave my bed, like I have really, really bad self-rated health, I'm not going to be going to like congregation anytime soon. And if I'm really, really unwell, this is going to negatively predict how happy I am with life. So there is in that case, especially, there's absolutely a bias happening. There's an intrinsic sampling bias. There's a selection on the predictor variable about what exactly that relationship is showing.
And I know that they say that isolation, which all of us are having in the pandemic, but isolation is very bad, especially for elderly people, and therefore there's some benefit to going to church because it's social, aside from the religion. But for someone like me, who's pretty much an introvert, and except in the pandemic, I'm usually around a lot of people at work, know a lot of people. I like my weekend to be off. I don't want to be necessarily around a lot of people.
She wants to sleep in on Sundays.
I want to sleep in on Sundays, and isn't that better for my health than making myself drag up and even go to a Unitarian society?
I'd like... To me, for me, it's whatever floats your boat. If you would rather lie in bed on a Sunday and, like, get some sleep, I wholeheartedly support your decision, and I envy you because I've got kids who just don't
right.
let me do that.
Our kids are grown
but,
up.
Oh, I'm waiting. I'm eagerly looking for that period of my life. But the idea that we have to, like, oh, you know, people are experiencing loneliness, which is a real, like, which is a real problem. But in this offsets the, you know, risk posed by the pandemic, it's kind of glib, because basically what's being argued, if you had presented this the other way, that, hey, you know, loneliness is, or, you know, people are going to die of COVID if they go out, and loneliness is a small price to pay, like, it would sound equally good either way. So I think if this is the argument people really want to advance, well, show the deaths associated with COVID and compare them to the deaths, or say the non-good health stuff associated with loneliness. And this is from someone who appreciates that loneliness is a really important thing. But if you've got, you know, a pandemic that has killed hundreds of thousands of people in your country, and loneliness probably hasn't killed hundreds of thousands of people, maybe that trade-off is arguably worth it, from my estimation without having any data in front of me.
So we're going to take a break here, Dr. Speed, and after the break, I have a couple of questions to ask you about these self-reported measures of well-being, and then about an issue you raised in your study about how religion does indeed provide more opportunities for social interaction. We're talking with Professor David Speed of the University of New Brunswick about his new study about atheism and health. We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio.
Garofalo, are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
Welcome back. I'm Dan Barker. We're continuing our conversation with Professor David Speed of the University of New Brunswick about his study comparing atheists and religious people and their health.
And that study is called Godless in the Great North White. And
in the Great White North.
Great White North. And Professor Speed, maybe we should clarify, that's a nickname for Canada, referring basically, I think, to the snow belt, right?
That is indeed what the nickname is in reference to. I chose it because I needed something to start with a G with the word godless. So Godless in the Great White North it was.
And so speaking of that, how do Canadians and Americans stack up in terms of religion and spirituality?
Generally, and this is me just, you know, based off my limited knowledge of what I know about the research, generally everything's bigger in America. So when we're talking about religiosity and spirituality, much more notable in America than Canada. Canada certainly has, it's comparable in some ways. But if you're looking at average religiosity, average religious attendance, if you're looking at other metrics of religion spirituality, the United States is winning much of that competition with Canada.
Well, so I'm out of touch, though, with how many non-believers there are statistically in Canada. We're about a quarter of the population.
Non-religious
today in the United States, which is a big change. And I remember Canada years ago used to be, I think, at least 30% unaffiliated. Is that still true?
It depends on what metric you're using. So if you're looking at modern data, around a quarter, I think, is probably a good estimate. But we're not actually sure how many atheists there are mm-hmm. in Canada relative to the United States. So University of Chicago, National Opinion Research Council, I think, runs something called the General Social Survey every year in the United States. And in 2018 for America, they asked the question, you know, do you believe in God? 1 in 6 Americans, give or take, indicated that they do not believe in God. So the percentage of atheists in America right now is about 15-ish%. So I'm really curious about what the number of atheists in Canada is, but we actually don't have a metric on that. We only have self-reported data. And at that point, we've got similar for people who explicitly identify as atheists in Canada, I think it's about 3-ish% of the population.
So in your study and in your research about religion and health, you point out that there's a difference between these self-reported measures of well-being and actual health outcomes. And in your study, you mentioned that, of course, religion does actually provide more opportunity for people to have the social interaction, which is important to health. So how do you tease out those differences between what they say and actually how healthy they are?
Really, realistically, this is like a major struggle, I think, within the broader religion health field, is that you have people who say, oh, no, I'm doing super well, but, you know, they're, you know, experiencing limitations with activities of daily living. So how do you tease out people who are actually well versus, like, not actually well? And it's really challenging. And this is part of the problem with studying religion and health. And this is part of the reason, I think, that you see this effect of religion promoting health, in quotation marks, is that people, they might be a bit more optimistic. They might see any sort of issue that they're experiencing as part of God's plan. So they're more optimistic about how they actually are. But when you look at objective health measures, it's a very different story. There tends to be very strong health parity between believers and non-believers, between religious groups and non-religious groups. I think when you look at stuff more objectively, where you actually are looking at these things, you see a much greater degree of similarity than difference. And I think this is where that type of religion-health relationship just kind of evaporates. A couple years ago, I published a paper that looked at screening behaviors like pap tests, mammograms, that sort of thing. And the conventional wisdom at the time was religious groups are going to have better scores because they treat their body as a temple, that sort of argumentation. But when you actually look at the data, it played a really inconsistent role. Sometimes religion was associated with better health outcomes, sometimes or screening behaviors. Other times it was associated with worse screening behaviors. So it's the objective measures that I think are probably the best way of doing it. Unfortunately, getting objective health measures in big survey data is really challenging because you often just have to rely on whatever the person is telling you, which is why you see some of this more grayish colored health measures being used.
So I've read that people who do surveys like this on any subject actually are skeptical, or they know that people who self-report tend to over-report socially desirable things and under-report socially undesirable. We kind of know that has to be factored into it. Is it possible that atheists are just more honest? I mean, if we're feeling bad, we say so, right? And if you're religious and you think your religion is helpful to you, you're going to rah-rah for your church and say, oh, yeah, I feel great. I'm a happy person. Is that possible?
Well, it's certainly possible. I don't know of any data comparing, like, genuine honesty levels of, like, atheists versus non-atheists, but you really hit the nail on the head when you mentioned the social desirability aspect, because there are several outcomes for health that just scream social desirability. So this one isn't health related, but if you're looking at, say, pornography consumption, if you shockingly religious attendance, religiosity, these things predict pornography consumption. But there is a really interesting paper published a few years ago called, I think it's called like Unbuckling the Bible Belt or something like that. But they looked at pornography consumption in various parts, I think, where they're looked, if I'm getting the details right, if I'm not, I apologize to the author. But I think they looked at pornography spikes or spikes in pornography use that coincided with, like, I think religious conventions or something. So it was really fascinating. But if you just ask, you know, do you watch pornography? Religious people on average report that they watch less pornography, and hey, maybe that's the case. But we can actually see arguably similar analogs in the health context if you're asking a person who is religious, hey, do you do drugs? Do you smoke? Do you drink alcohol? You see lower reported rates of this. So what's happening...
But it's really hard to know if it's true, right?
Yeah, it is. Like, I mean, if you have, like, traditionally, like, very conservative religious groups, like if you find, like, Orthodox Jews were less likely to drink alcohol, or Orthodox Muslims were less likely to drink alcohol, I would take that finding at face value. That's generally something that seems very reasonable. But part of the problem is that, let's say that you are Muslim or Jewish or conservative Christian who starts drinking alcohol or smoking pot on the weekend. What ends up happening is you might self-select out of that religious group because you're like, I'm really liking the taste of this, Trappist ale from Belgium, and I don't want to give that up. So maybe I'm not as conservative as I think. Maybe I'm a little bit less religious than I thought I was, because all my peers, they're super religious, but they're not drinking the, you know, great beer from Belgium like I am. So I think that could definitely be a factor driving it. But the hard part is, well, how do you tease this out? And this is the thing. So what I try to do is, like, shine a light on it. My colleague, Dr. Ryan Cragen from the University of Tampa, and my graduate student, Caitlin Berry, who's now at Queen's University in Canada, we published a paper in Social Science and Medicine a couple months ago, which looked at religion and spirituality predicting a variety of health outcomes. And the only ones that social support didn't really seem to touch were drug use or substance use and alcohol use. And we had pointed
out
that
out of time
this may
here.
Actually be a selection bias. Oh.
Well, we're sorry, Dr. Spooper, out of time. We actually had Ryan Cragen on our show a couple years ago, another great researcher. Thank you. People can find your article in the Journal of Religion and Health. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Buzz, for producing. Thank you, listeners in Philadelphia to WOOM. Thank you, listeners in Madison, Wisconsin, WID and WMUU. Janesville, WADR. Bryan, Texas, KEOS. Columbia, Missouri, KOPN. Eugene, Oregon, KEPW. San Marcos, Texas, KZSM. Vermont, New Hampshire, WOOL. And Ithaca and Watkins Glen, New York, WRFI. If you listen to the podcast, give us a thumbs up and tell people to visit our webpage at ffrf.org/radio.
Ask for more information or join us at ffrf.org in our vital work so that reason and our secular constitution will prevail. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday